carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, do consider letting them know you like this show.
Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. You don't need to be a scientist to hold that lamp. Look for evidence. Keep on thinking. Trimberger.org.
Ah, the many colors of the blues. And you can hear them on WHFR's latest blues compilation, Uncut Detroit 3, Live Studio Blues, featuring local artists Bugs Beddo, Thornetta Davis, Eileen Orr, Kenny Parker, Robert Penn, Harmonica Shaw, and Joe Weaver. This CD has received great reviews, and we know that you will love it too. Support independent radio and order your copy of Uncut Detroit 3 Live Studio Blues for only $12. Go to our website at whfr.fm or give us a call at 313-845-9676.
Hello, I'm Lorena McKennett, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn.
It's Philosophy Talk.
We're the country that put a man on the moon, and we're also the country that created the rumor that we did not put a man on the moon.
Is believing in conspiracy theories a sign of paranoia?
Isn't rejecting conspiracy theories a sign of naivete?
It doesn't make any sense. He drove past the book depository, and the police said conclusively that it was an exit wound. So how is it possible for Oswald to have fired from two angles at once? It doesn't make sense.
If you've got a good conspiracy theory, don't let evidence get in the way.
Oh, my God. Barack Obama's running the old Kenyan Prince birth announcement scam.
Our guest is Brian Keeley from Pitzer College.
The great story here is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president.
Conspiracy theories.
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, Scully.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken and I conspire to corrupt the youth.
And today, we're thinking about conspiracy theories.
You mean those theories that paranoid nut jobs like to spend all the time defending?
You're kind of quick to judge there, John. You're full of prejudice.
Oh, come on, Ken. Don't tell me you buy any of that stuff. A secret group of elites, probably Jews or Freemasons, maybe even shape-shifting lizard aliens who control and manipulate the global economy, or 97% of the world's climate scientists for some obscure reason are lying about global warming, or Elvis faked his own death.
Well, what about Watergate, John, or the NSA spying on U.S. citizens? Those conspiracy theories turned out to be true, didn't they? So how can believing the truth make somebody a paranoid nutjob, as you so tactfully put it?
Even a stopped watch is right twice a day. If you think everything is a conspiracy, occasionally you will be right. You can cherry pick the one or two cases that have happened to work out as conspiracies. That doesn't change the fact that the vast majority of these theories are just wacky and have no basis in reality.
Question everything, John. I'm surprised at your stubbornness, but how can you be so confident that conspiracy theories are false? I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure you haven't investigated them all for yourself, have you? You have some principled basis for just rejecting them out of hand?
Three words, Ken. Lack of evidence.
Watergate? The NSA? Come on.
All right, let me back up a little bit. Make a distinction. That's what philosophers are paid to do. Surely there are conspiracies. More than one person gets together, a group of people, they conspire, they do something evil, so there was a conspiracy. Somebody comes up with a theory that's correct, conspiracy theory, correct conspiracy theory. That's not what I have in mind. Maybe what I have in mind I should call a meta-conspiracy theory. you have some bad event like Kennedy's assassination. Of course, we don't ever know everything that happened, but all the evidence we can get points to Oswald doing it. We spend a lot of time looking for evidence. 50, 60 years later, still no solid evidence that anyone else was involved. And yet, people say, that's just because the conspirators were so good. First, they conspired to get Kennedy killed, and then they've done this amazing 50, 60-year-old job of making sure that nobody figures out the right theory of what happened. That's the kind of conspiracy I have in mind, and it's all bull.
No, John, wait a minute. You just said it yourself. Look, what do you think a good conspirator would do? They conspire to kill Kennedy. They're trying to hide their tracks, so they set up Oswald as the patsy. And then what do? They kill Oswald. So, of course, there's no evidence. Of course, all the evidence points to Oswald. That's how they arranged it.
Well, there's a veneer of plausibility in what you say. Back in 1963, 1964, everybody had an open mind about these possibilities. But when the time goes on and no conspirator breaks, nobody confesses 50 years later, you got to be crazy to stick with these meta-conspiracy theories.
Who says there's no evidence? Come on, take the 9/11 conspiracy. You know, the planes knock the buildings down. But what about Building 7? That was no plane. That was no random collapse. That was controlled demolition. And only the 9/11 conspiracy theorists can explain it, John.
Well, you know, I'm no engineer, but I do find the hypothesis that Buildings 1 and 2 fell because the planes ran into them extremely plausible. And if some little building didn't kind of conform to what people expected, what in the world is that supposed to show?
It's supposed to show there's a conspiracy. You're just focusing on one little piece of evidence by itself when there's a whole lot more than that. You can't just dismiss the theory until you've actually carefully examined all the evidence, John, all of it.
Ken, you're starting to sound like a skit from Portlandia. I mean, if you want to spend the declining years of your life investigating every wacky conspiracy theory out there, be my guest. But I want no part of it.
I didn't say all of them, but you still haven't convinced me that I should simply disregard every single conspiracy theory just because they haven't been proven yet, John.
Well, maybe this will convince you. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to learn more about some conspiracy theories that a lot of people still believe. She files this report.
Around noon on November 22, 1963, President Kennedy and his wife Jacqueline greeted crowds in Dallas, Texas, before riding to a luncheon with local officials. We all know what happened next.
The word we have is that President Kennedy is dead. He was shot by an assassin at the intersection of Elm and Houston streets just as he was going into the underpass. The word we have is from a doctor on the staff of Parkland Hospital who says that it is true. He was in tears when he told me just a moment ago.
Nothing can be done to dissuade broad swathes of the American public from being convinced that there was more foul play than we understand at foot in the Kennedy assassination.
Tom Wood studies conspiracy theories at the University of Chicago, and he's right. As of 2013, 61% of respondents said they believed numerous people conspired to kill Kennedy. For example,
that the United States government acted in cahoots with organized crime interests in the United States. Like, that's a fairly fanciful thing to believe. I mean, if that was the stuff of a Hollywood movie, it would be derided as fanciful.
Wood has studied many conspiracy theories. He's found that 1 in 6 Americans believe the U.S. government played a part in the September 11th attacks, and about 1 in 4 believe President Obama has concealed information about where he was born. Lately, Wood and his co-author Eric Oliver have been studying medical conspiracy theories. They asked volunteers a series of questions like,
do you believe the FDA is colluding with pharmaceutical companies to suppress information about natural cures for cancer?
A third of responders said yes. Here's another one.
Do you think the medical community knows vaccines can cause autism, yet promotes them anyway?
20% believe that one's true. And around 12% said they believed a few other conspiracy theories. For example,
this idea that the Central Intelligence Agency had been involved in the infecting broad swathes of the American public with AIDS. this claim that global food companies are distributing genetically modified foods to shrink the global population as a part of a shadowy conspiracy called Agenda 21.
Or that fluoride is added to our drinking water to make us politically passive.
If you drink it over the course of your life, it's going to affect your thyroid, it's going to affect your glands, your tissues, your brain.
Here's a clip from Alex Jones, a conspiracy theorist with an internet news show.
You still see the controlled media trying to push for it, always trying to tell you, well, it's good for teeth, drink the poison down.
So my question, of course, is how do you know people who believe wild conspiracy theories aren't right?
That is like the easily the most common reaction to the project.
According to Tom Wood from the University of Chicago, 1 in 5 people say the most surprising thing about this study is that more people don't believe in conspiracy theories.
Our academic work doesn't turn on whether these accounts are false or true. We're just interested in the determinants of these attitudes and some of the consequences for people's behavior and attitudes.
It turns out if you believe medical conspiracy theories, you're less likely to seek decent health care.
Regularly visiting the dentist, getting a health checkup, wearing sunscreen, those behaviors are reliably suppressed by adoption of these medical conspiracies.
So if you buy into these conspiracy theories, Wood says you're probably just hurting yourself. Unless, of course, you are correct and commercial airliners really are dropping secret vaccines in their vapor trails and cell phones really do cause brain tumors. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is my Stanford co-conspirator, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about conspiracy theories. We're joined now by Brian Keeley. He's a professor of philosophy at Pitzer College. He's author of Conspiracy Theories. Brian, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, John and Ken. How you doing?
Doing fine, Brian. Now, Brian, you were the one who really got the debate started in philosophy about conspiracy theories with this fabulous article you wrote. What is it about conspiracy theories that got you intrigued?
Well, actually, the way I got into conspiracy theories is that I was working in philosophy, and I was working actually in the area of neuroscience, and I was doing work on the philosophy of neuroscience and was having a hard time getting people to take me seriously as a philosopher. So I tried to think of what could I publish on that had nothing to do with neuroscience, but that would be more clearly philosophical. And so I'm actually the only person I can think of who actually thought that working on conspiracy theories would make me more employable as opposed to less employable.
Well, that's a good practical explanation. But having gotten into this, can you tell us, is there any more to say about conspiracy theories other than what I say? They're crazy hypotheses dreamed up by paranoid and deluded people?
Well, one thing I always like to do is make sure that we distinguish talking about the conspiracy theorist from their actual theories. Because one of the problems, if you think of the conspiracy theorist as paranoid, often, you know, the only evidence you have for that is the fact that they hold this crazy theory. So mm-hmm. I'm actually kind of more interested often in looking at the actual theories themselves. Because, you know, theories, as Ken was pointing out, there are times where conspiracy theories seem to be things that we ought to believe in. Watergate, so, Iran-Contra, you name it.
So where does this idea come from that conspiracy theorists are wacko nut jobs? I mean, since there are conspiracy, one might think if one has lived through the history of humanity, since politicians conspire, mafia conspire, all kinds of people conspire. Mm-hmm. If one's lived through the history of humanity, one should be a conspiracy theorist. So where does the idea come from that there's something wrong rather than something prescient with conspiracy theorists? Where does that come from?
I don't know. I think part of it might just be that there certainly are people whose personalities seem to really go for these all the time, you know, that, you know, everything is a conspiracy and, you know, there's nothing has a normal explanation. It always has this kind of conspiratorial edge to it. And I think, you know, maybe those people just give us give the conspiracy theories a bad name in some way because they just never get off the bandwagon. They're always just pushing the same type of argument all the time.
Well, in your article, you make the point that there's something very human about conspiracy theorists in the sense that we've always yearned for a meaningful universe. We would like things to have an explanation that's not just in terms of little ions and molecules doing their thing, but some mind, something like our consciousness. And this, although, you know, it in a way makes the world a crazier place because there's all these conspiracies. In a way, it makes it a more friendly place because at least most of what's happening isn't just random. So it's to be conspiracy theorist is to be human.
Yeah, in some ways, I like to think of conspiracy theorists as kind of the last deist, right? The last people who think that, you know, the world really does make sense, and that, you know, particularly the bigger the event that happens, the bigger the meaning behind it. You know, if conspiracy theorists are wrong, right, and things just do happen, right, then the world probably becomes a lot scarier of a place, right, where planes just disappear as they're flying across the ocean, and presidents just happen to get shot when their, you know, their car goes past a guy on his lunch hour so that he can actually get a shot off. I mean, if the world is full of all these kind of random events, that's, in some sense, that's a scarier world than a world in which there's, you know, at least somebody in control. It's just, you know, but they have a bad, nefarious idea behind it.
Yeah, you know, Brian, I wonder, is it a nefarious world with dark agents or a random world? We'll talk more about that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about conspiracy theories with Brian Keeley from Pitzer College.
Do you believe any conspiracy theories? Do you think any of them are well-reasoned, or are they all just irrational?
Conspiracy theories, rationality, and belief, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
What is that sound? I think it's a conspiracy, but maybe it's just my paranoia. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're conspiring to learn more about conspiracy theories.
Our guest is Brian Keeley from Pitzer College. And Brian will be a part of a live chat on our community of thinkers Friday, May 2nd at 12 noon Pacific time. You join the chat by going to philosophytalk.org.
Brian, so I want to think about not conspiracy theorists just yet, but conspiracy theories. Is there something intrinsically wrong with conspiracy theories that make them one and all faulty? Are they faulty in different ways? What, can we dismiss them out of hand right away? If so, how? If not, why not?
Yeah, that was my original idea original thing I wanted to explore is this idea that a lot of people, particularly academics, kind of think of them as things that we can just dismiss out of hand, right? That there's just something wrong. You can tell just when somebody presents the theory that it's wrong. And one of the things that I think I came to from studying it is that, fortunately, it's not that easy. I mean, there are certainly conspiracy theories we should believe in and those some that we shouldn't, but you can't tell on, you know, maybe the very first day which one is which. I mean, if somebody came to you, you know, hey, I think, you know, the president was behind the, you know, breaking into a political opponent's office last night, that sounds like a crazy conspiracy theory. But, you know, that one is one that turned out maybe to be right if Watergate actually happened.
Yeah, but there's something, I mean, take Freudian theories. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure there's a lot to what Freud and psychoanalysts say, but sometimes there is this kind of form of argument where you say, well, if you object to my explanation, that's because you're engaging in, you know, some kind of neurotic behavior that doesn't allow you to accept my explanation. So it seems like there's some kind of feature of the theory that makes it irrefutable or unfalsifiable, or any evidence against it is automatically explained, not as evidence by it. There seems to be something like that in some of these theories. Not every time there's a theory that there's a conspiracy, but some of these theories seem to have an element like that. Is that something you explored and you just couldn't quite put your finger on it, or
yeah,
what do you think?
I do think it's kind of interesting that, you know, conspiracy theories tend to be the only theories that you can really think of that evidence against them is actually taken as evidence for them, right? Because it just shows you how much they want you to not believe the theory. And so we have this idea that, yeah, that there seems to be something unfalsifiable about them, this idea that, you know, that there's nothing you could ever show to prove them wrong. But part of that is that, you know, falsifiability is a perfectly fine criterion to use when you're studying the natural world, right? It comes from, you know, we don't want unfalsifiable theories of the psyche if you're Freud. But when you're studying the human world, where, you know, you actually expect you know, murderers to try to cover their tracks. You expect powerful agencies like the NSA and the CIA to put out disinformation. I mean, it would be a pretty bad murder detective who, you know, as soon as he found out that one of his suspects had an alibi, to just simply say, oh, okay, he has an alibi. I'm not going to explore it any deeper. Because you'd kind of expect somebody who's carried out a murder to like at least try to set up a good alibi for themselves.
But look, there's also this, isn't there? I mean, conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorists who believe them actually think their explanations are better explanations than the official explanation often. Because, like you in your paper, you mentioned the BAT, the Oklahoma City bombing, and there were no law enforcement officers in the building. Why weren't there any? Right, even it's a government building. They knew what was coming. Mm-hmm. Right, the standard theory, McVeigh did it. There's no explanation of why there weren't any of the law enforcement officers there. So it's a better, it's a more complete explanation. What about that thought?
Well, I think you know actually something like the Oklahoma City bombing and a lot of these conspiracies. What's interesting is that every theory that's out there is some type of conspiracy theory, right? It either was a conspiracy on the behalf of Timothy McVeigh and his friends who carried out a bombing, or the alternative explanation is, you know, is the federal government somehow behind it. So one of the kind of interesting things is almost all the theories on all sides are conspiracies of one sort or another. So you're kind of like battling conspiracies against conspiracies.
But I'm just talking about the conspiracy theory as opposed to the official non-conspiratorial explanation. Isn't there often something to be said for the conspiracy theory that it's a more complete explanation? Because it leaves fewer things unexplained?
That's one of the things that thinks it's really interesting about conspiracy theories is, you know, one of the general features of good scientific explanation is that it covers a lot of, you know, explains a lot of stuff and connects together things that you wouldn't otherwise think are connected. And that's actually one of the features I think the conspiracy theories have that are actually good. As you point out, right, a good conspiracy theory can not only explain, things that aren't covered by the official story, it also can explain why the official story looks as good as it looks, right? Because that's the way they set it up.
Right. So you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about conspiracy theories with Brian Keeley. We've got Wes in Portland on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Wes.
Hey, thanks for having me on. So the point pretty much what I wanted to say is, I really feel like the majority of conspiracy theories are just obviously bunk, like the idea that, like you were saying earlier, the 97% of the scientific community is in on, you know, the conspiracy theory for global warming and blah, 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 blah. But then there are certain things like the whole 9/11 inside job thing where you watch the video and you're just like, yeah, man, how did those guys learn to drive a 747? And should a plane really knock down that building? I'm not sure. That sort of stuff. And then it just kind of launches you into this echo chamber where if that's true, well, man, maybe all this other stuff is true.
Yeah, that's a good question, Wes. What do you think, Brian? Thanks, Wes.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that I think leads people to doubt conspiracy theories, I think correctly after a while, is just this idea that, you know, maybe on the first day it happens, conspiracy theory has, you know, something going for it. But as time goes on and more investigation is done and more different, you know, lines of thought are looked into and it just doesn't pan out, right? That part of the only way you can continue to hold on to the conspiracy theory is if the conspiracy itself gets bigger and bigger, right? Like the New York Times now has to be in on it and the FBI has to be in on it. And it gets, you have to worry sometimes that you don't want your conspiracy theory to get to the point where the only way you can believe in the conspiracy is if you disbelieve everything. The conspiracy theories can kind of start to undermine themselves after a while just because you start to have no reason to believe anything.
Well, on November 23rd, 1963, I was watching TV and I saw Ruby shoot Oswald in the garage. And wow, I was immediately thinking this is a conspiracy, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, whether Oswald shot Kennedy or not, he was part of some conspiracy. And now this, you know, Dallas nightclub owner is... has shot him. And I think you'd have to be irrational not to have thought at that moment, wow, something bigger and more extensive is involved. But then year after year goes by and theory comes up and theory goes down. And a lot of investigators think that the larger the conspiracy is, the less likely it is that no one breaks the code of silence. So there's something about the conspiracy theory that it has to get larger as time goes by, and yet at the same time, it has to get more implausible. Is there some diagnosis like that that can set some of these theories aside?
That's what I eventually think for a lot of conspiracy theories, why you shouldn't believe in them. It's not because there's something, inherently wrong with the theory by definition. But yeah, over time, it becomes less and less plausible. And if you think about it, there's certain things you have to have in place if you're really going to successfully pull off a conspiracy. I think, the best candidates for, groups of people who might actually be able to carry off conspiracies successfully are things like mafias, right? Family organizations where you've got a small group of people who have a very, very tight connection to one another, and they're also maybe particularly brutal as well. They might be able to pull off conspiracies because they have, a family relationship
I get you guys, Brian. I get you and John. But so basically what you're saying is that, conspiracies are hard to pull off. They're hard to cover up. They're hard to keep secret. And so that's a reason, for the most part, not to believe that one happened. But that doesn't show anything about the intrinsic irrationality of conspiracy theories. They just may be the least probable, but that doesn't make them irrational. I think we have a caller who wants to get in on this point, maybe on your side rather than my side. Cody in Portland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Cody.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. What's your comment or question?
My comment is, John mentioned earlier, actually, that the conspiracy theorists and the most common conspiracies could just stem from our need for rationality in these events when they occur. And I was thinking, along the lines of John F. Kennedy. Had he been an incredibly unpopular president, do you think that the conspiracy would have stretched on as long as it has? If there was a reason for somebody to assassinate him from some poor policy or something that he did, say the Bay of Pigs actually went forward and then he was shot, do you believe that a conspiracy of this depth would have ever existed?
Brian, you ever thought about that? I don't have a thought about that, Brian.
I think there is something, that idea that, the bigger the event, the more it calls for, an explanation. Kennedy was, incredibly well loved by a lot of people. It was, horrible for a lot of people to see him killed. And therefore you think there's gotta be even more of a reason. And look at the way 9/11, is such a huge event in the history of the American, the recent American history. And it's like, okay, that has to have some really deep, meaningful thing behind it. It can't just be a simple answer, right? So, it just seems like it calls for a big answer.
So you think part of what drives human beings to consume and produce conspiracy theories is this need to narrate the world in sort of agency-like terms rather than random happening-like terms. Stuff just happens. Kennedy gets shot or stuff like that just happens. Some guys happen to fly a plane into, well, that was a conspiracy, but not an insight. Stuff just happens. But somehow, do you think we find it more satisfying? It would be nice if there were nice stories to tell about human agency. God made this happen because he loves us, but the bad guys make it happen. Is that really more humanly satisfying?
Well, there's also the hopeful side of conspiracy theories, which is that, there's a reason why people pursue them, because they think, if we can just get the truth out there, we can save things, right? We can be Woodward and Bernstein and take down a president, a bad president. That, the truth will set us free in a way. And I think that's one of the things that really pushes a lot of conspiracy theorists, because there's really a big piece of hope there as well, right? This hope that if all we can do is, get the truth out there, then we can correct things, right? That we don't have to be a victim of these evil people. We can, we can save the world.
Now, to me, there's a big difference between 9/11 and JFK on this score. With 9/11, you had this colossal event, these twin towers falling down and the airplanes going into them. But on the other hand, it was the product of a colossal war, a centuries-long building competition between radical Muslims and corporate power or something like that. Even without any unofficial explanation, there's a kind of pretty satisfying story where the immensity of the effect is matched by the gravity of the cause. But with JFK, it's a lone nut job, sitting in a school depository with a gun, who knocks down the most popular president we'd had in quite a while. So it really, to me, it is totally inappropriate, and it shouldn't be that way, but it is.
Yeah, I think we also probably weren't helped by the fact that, you know, the Warren Commission report that was supposed to kind of solve all this for us, it, you know, at least my looking back on it, they could have done a better job, right? I mean, I think they left so many openings for future conspiracy theorists to work through, you know, people burning their notes and other things that just, you know, they kind of set themselves up for it, right? They were trying to get it out of the way really quickly and move on to the next thing. And maybe if they'd done a little bit less sloppy work, we might be in a better position now.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about conspiracy theories with Brian Keeley, author of Conspiracy Theories. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Chloe in Portland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chloe.
Hi. I just wanted to hear your opinion on John Lennon's assassination.
That's for Brian or John or me?
To you.
I don't have an opinion. Brian, I'm no expert on any of these things. Brian, you have an opinion on John Lennon's assassination?
Not in particular. I don't know of any. I mean, I don't know of a lot of conspiracy theories revolving around it. I mean, there's a lot of conspiracy theories about, you know, whether Paul McCartney was dead earlier on and things. but that particular one, I'm not...
Well, we knew that Lennon, you know, like Martin Luther King, was targeted in various ways by the CIA and had mm-hmm. visa problems and so forth. I'm not a believer in a conspiracy theory there because I think they've got a pretty plausible nut job that did the case. But there's some grounds for it.
Let me ask you a different kind of question, Brian. Suppose, I mean, part of me thinks, well, maybe it's a good thing that human beings, at least some of us, are prone to conspiracy theories. Because if we're all sort of hyper-cautious, hyper-accepting the official line and all that sort of stuff, and just willing to swallow it whole, well, we would have never gotten Watergate uncovered and all these things that are... So, you know, the propensity to believe in conspiracy theories... And suppose that you're in the Pleistocene and you meet some stranger or a group of strangers. The propensity to believe that they might be conspiring against you can, you know, be a good thing because they might be conspiring against you. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think I agree with you because I think, you know, like I said, I think some conspiracy theories are ones we ought to believe in, and I think we ought to investigate them, right? I think it's actually one good thing that we have is that we have things like a free press or investigative journalism. We have lots of free agents like people who can explore things, and sometimes they are going to dig stuff up. And I think, you know, it's part of a healthy society to have dissent. And I think it's part of a healthy society to have people that are kind of, you know, questioning whether the emperor has any clothes on and generally challenging things.
So we've got email from Arvin who says, how is the story of the Bible and those portions of other holy texts not a conspiracy theory? Not sure what he has in mind, but he might have a lot of plausible things in mind. How do you react to that, Brian?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting because one of the original ideas that I had for the paper was coming out of actually philosophy of religion, because I was kind of interested in what David Hume had to say about miracles and how he thought that miracles, by definition, were things that we should not believe in. So it has this kind of beginning in religion, and actually a paper that I wrote after the one that we're talking about today is about God as the ultimate conspiracy theory, right? Because in some sense, another kind of connection to all this is this idea that if you really think that, you know, God has a plan for the world, you know, and every time, you know, something really bad happens, like, you know, a school bus full of kids goes off the road, somebody will say, oh, you know, there must have been, you know, God must have had some reason for this happening. And that kind of way of thinking about things kind of turns God into the greatest conspirator, right? He's the one, you know, behind the scenes that's making, you know, pulling all the strings and making everything happen.
Bigger even than the CIA.
Yeah, exactly.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about conspiracy theories with Brian Keeley, author of Conspiracy Theories.
Coming up after the break, are there any guidelines, any rules of thumb to help us figure out when to actively investigate a conspiracy theory and when to say, oh, no, that's just bizarre?
The do's and don'ts of good conspiracy theorizing when Philosophy Talk continues.
Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean there's nothing up their sleeve. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Brian Keeley from Pitzer College, and we're thinking about conspiracy theories. Now, Brian will also be part of a live chat at our online community of thinkers on Friday, May 2nd, and you are invited. So we've got a caller in the line, Kathy in Salem. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kathy.
Hi. I'm calling. I'd like to make this a little bit more concise at this point, but I think part of what happens is when people hear part of something that they know is to be true, discredited, then they become suspicious overall. And I don't think there's a strong bent onto how to do credible research for a lot of people, but I'll tell you briefly. I was told to focus on one thing. My background is working in the healthcare industry, and I interviewed for headquarters marketing with one of the major pharmaceuticals. But when people told me aspartame or aspartame wasn't good for you, I went straight to the journal. And all of the journals indicated that the animal test subjects who developed brain tumors and subsequently died in the Stanford really highly respected institution. Donald Rumsfeld at the time was CEO of Searle, and he was trying to get this through. The FDA refused to approve the med, I mean the drug, and he swore that he would get it through when Reagan was elected. Within 1 month of Reagan's election, they fired the head of the FDA, hired a new one. Normally they had a five-man panel, and instead they had somebody else sitting on the vote for aspartame. So it was there were six people. So, and the vote got through for it.
So, Kathy, I think we've got the gist of the question. I think we've got the gist of a question. It's a complicated situation. Thanks for the question. So, Brian, what do you think about this kind of thing in general?
Well, one of the things that's, you know, you always run into is that some of the best conspiracy theories, the ones that have they're dealing with something that's really complicated. And, you know, I've had a hard time getting my head around a lot of the 9/11 conspiracy theories because there's just so much going on in them. And it sounds like this kind of story as well. I mean, I think one of the things that happens is that you kind of, at some point you have to throw up your hands where you're like, I can't study this enough to find out one way or the other. And you just kind of have to sit back and hope that investigative journalists pick it up, hope that, you know, we have a lot of, you know, mechanisms in our society where somebody who could, you know, break out a big story, you know, they're going to get a Pulitzer Prize if they can, you know, show that something that's, you know, some big conspiracy is being pulled over on us. So that's about all I can do.
You know, what the conspiracy theorists have right is that there are a lot of big agencies, institutions, corporations, governments, and I think more than governments, parts of governments, you know, institutions within governments like the NSA, that have everything you need to be a conspiracy because they've already got a lot of people working together for common goals. And then if their corporate goals are antithetical to the common good, then you've got conspiracies. So it's very important to take the possibility of conspiracies as real and to have people investigating them all the time. However, I think we need to mark out this special category of theorists who think that even if all the investigations have come up empty, and also with any crime, you need to have a plausible motive. A lot of conspiracy theories don't give us a plausible motive. I don't know what the plausible motive for 9/11 is on the part of the CIA or the Bush government or anything like that. So I think a lot of the criteria you would use just to solve the crime of who ate the cookies in the kitchen, if you stick to those things, there's got to be motive, there's got to be opportunity. It can carry a long way in dividing the real conspiracy theories from the wacko ones.
I think Alexis in Portland has some insight here. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alexis. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. No, I just wanted to comment about how conspiracy theories are also completely entertaining. You can spend all day on YouTube and check out stuff about how Obama is a reptilian alien, about the most ridiculous things, and it's just, oh, and the Illuminati is controlling everything. Hilarious. Miley Cyrus. Oh, man. Just type in YouTube, Miley Cyrus, Illuminati. You can watch that stuff for hours. It's entertaining.
Thanks, Alexis. I think she's right. I mean, I think there is something to conspiracy theories. It's an engaging world to, way to see the world in these terms. It makes the, you know, Wordsworth has this poem that says, "Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasantly, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn." Right? I mean, I want to look at the world in a way that, you know, is fun to look at. And maybe looking at the world in conspiratorial terms makes it more fun to be in.
Well, that makes a, I mean, she makes an interesting point, and I think there's a connection there between conspiracy theories and the whole institution of fiction. I mean, basically, why do we like fiction? Because we like stories. And the world doesn't offer us enough stories. I mean, we have all the biographies of people who lived and died. Yeah, we want more. You know, we want Poirot. We want Sherlock Holmes. And, you know, maybe there's just not enough real conspiracies out there to keep the brains of all the people that enjoy thinking about conspiracies occupied. Very good point.
What do you think, Brian? What do you think?
No, I think if you're driving across country and all you can pick up is AM radio, yeah, you can, you know, while away several hours listening to, you know, various AM radio talk shows where they're spinning out various conspiracies. Yeah, I agree. It can be it's a lot of fun sometimes.
And it's not just a lot of fun. It's a deep human thing. Because here's the thing, I think this goes back to God, too. But it goes back to lots of things. It goes back to something psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. That's a complicated thing, but it says people tend to explain other people's behavior more in terms of their agency and their character traits than situations, although they explain their own things in terms of situations more than, you know, I mean, he stumbled. I stumbled because there was a thing there. He stumbled because he's clumsy, right? Mm-hmm. So we like to see the world filled with agency. And conspiracy theories really ratchets up the agency explanations. There's something deep in humans about seeing the world as people with agents. That's why we believe in God, because we think there's a big agent in the sky. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. That part of also is that, you know, gives us a world in which, you know, there are clear villains and there are clear good guys and bad guys, right? The good guys are the conspiracy theorists who are trying to, you know, save us. And then the bad guys are all these nefarious people behind the scenes, the they that you always hear about that are trying to control us and make money off of us and so forth. I mean, it has that structure of fiction. I think you're right.
There's a connection. I mean, I like one thing in your article very well, much where you say that conspiracy theorists are kind of picking up on an 18th and 19th century theme, mm-hmm. that even if there is no God or there's no traditional God, there's still lots of sources of order in the world, and it's not just chaotic and random. Mm-hmm. Whereas the more quantum theoretical 21st century approaches, that there's just a lot of stuff that just happens with no deep explanation. And are we happy with, I mean, would we all be happier if we were conspiracy theorists? They're usually a pretty happy crowd.
Yeah, I think, you know, they, like I said, we have hope, right, that we can control the world. I mean, one of the things I think it comes out of this picture is that, you know, if you're a conspiracy theorist, then you have to presume that, you know, humans and the world can be controlled. And the alternative, if conspiracy theorists aren't right, then in some sense the world kind of just happens and we can't control it. It's just one thing after another, and that's that can be pretty scary.
Okay, so now let's take a. We got this event. We got this missing plane. We're going to get a lot of theories about that. If you mm-hmm. don't have enough, you can watch CNN. Or mm-hmm. Now, can you, as an expert on this, can you give us some rules of thumb as these theories comes up? Which ones should we just kind of reject out of hand? Which ones are more plausible? Are there any signs? Any telltale things that say, ah, those experts aren't really experts? They're just wrong.
Well, one thing you can do is something that you mentioned a few minutes ago, which is to see whether the person who's proposing something is actually proposing a theory or whether they're just merely asking questions, right? You know, how do they explain this? How do they explain that? I don't have a theory of what's going on. I just, you know, I'm picking at points here and there. Because I think one of the things that you see in most conspiracy theories is what I call errant data, right? There's always some piece of the story that just doesn't fit. Like in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing, there were two people they thought were involved, John Doe number one and John Doe number two. And we had, you know, pictures of them going around. And John Doe number one turned out to be Timothy McVeigh. We never figured out who John Doe number two was. And you know, there's an unexplained little piece of errant data that could be the, you know, the beginning of the string where you start to pull everything apart. So part of it is just not be too worried that if there are errant data, because when we're dealing with humans, there's always going to be problems and always be things that we're going to be overlooking, or somebody's just going to report something wrong or something along those lines.
But isn't letting errant data go, isn't that a dangerous thing? That's like the Challenger disaster. You put it in there and the O-ring breaks because of the code. I mean, missing things like that, isn't that a bad thing?
Well, I think, I don't know, Francis Crick used to say this thing where he said that you don't want your theory to fit all the data, because all the data isn't true. That, you know, there's always going to be bad recordings, you know, bad eyewitnesses and so forth. In fact, you should be, and particularly you should be suspicious of a theory that explains everything, right? Because at least some of the things that you think need explaining probably just were mistakes.
Well, on that note of wisdom, Brian, I'm going to thank you for joining us. This has been an inspiring and conspirational, if that's a word, conversation. So thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Brian Keeley. He's a professor of philosophy at Pitzer College. He's author of Conspiracy Theories. So, John, what are you conspiring to think these days?
What am I conspiring to think? Well, I think when bad things happen to me, I do instantly start fashioning conspiracy theories. Right, so and so turned philosophy talk down for a grant because they're a bunch of crit-lit people that don't appreciate philosophy and so forth and so on. So it takes some effort not to fall into this thinking where everything bad thing that happens to you and maybe everything that bad thing that happens to anybody is the result of some evil intent on the part of one or more persons. But by and large, it's just, as they say, a certain stuff that starts with S and ends with T happens, and that's it.
Well, stuff does happen, but, you know, I do think conspiracy theories, I think they have a deep hold on the human psyche. It's non-accidental, because we really do want to see the world in terms of human agency. It's not just coincidence. It's not just happenstance. People are out there doing things. They're doing things for reasons. Sometimes they're trying to hide the reasons. Sometimes they're trying to make the reasons known. But the conspiracy theorist is always thinking, there's more reason behind there. There are hidden reasons here. I think that's an important thing.
And not just humans, aliens, archangels, all kinds of evil forces out there, Ken.
Okay. Well, this conversation continues on at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. And you're invited to join today's guest, Brian Keeley, in a live chat at the Community of Thinkers on Friday, May 2nd at 12 noon Pacific time.
Now let's hear from the most conspiratorial speed talker we know, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, in my younger days, I would visit donut shops at 3 a.m. where I would sometimes find myself in conversation with a guy claiming they had just been axed by the Pentagon from a clandestine op in Cambodia because he knew too much. This fellow smelled like whiskey and stale beer. That could have been just a cover, though I don't think a spy generally admits he's a spy, especially in a coffee house at 3 a.m. So I take conspiracy theories with a grain of salt. They have a tang of whiskey and stale beer about them, and would probably also reek of hallucinogens if LSD had an aroma. Paradoxically, we only believe in conspiracies until they're proven to be true. Then they become something else, a botched attempt, a fiendish plan. Take the Lincoln assassination. That was the result of an actual conspiracy, but we don't think of it that way. It was kind of a mess. John Wilkes Booth succeeded in killing the president, but broke his leg in the process, wound up getting shot while on the lam. The vice president was also supposed to be killed, but his would-be assassin got drunk and forgot. And Secretary of State Seward escaped death because the assassin's gun misfired. Knowing all that kind of ruins things, conspiracy-wise, I think of conspiracies as complicated and unlikely hidden explanations for any events that disrupt the world as we know it. The more outlandish the theory, the more we want to believe. Many conspiracy theories have their roots in the Enlightenment. Secular introspection had concluded that God was perhaps not the prime mover of human actions, and civilization became really nervous. Protestants started rushing to America. Jesuits began turning the Catholic Church into not Protestantism. We had Rosicrucians. We had the Illuminati. We had Jesuits versus Jansenists, Catholics versus Freemasons. The Enlightenment was the breeding ground for democracy, science, economics, moral philosophy, and coffee houses. In turn, the breeding ground for conspiracies and their theories. Hence, the Illuminati were the secret promoters of the French and American revolutions. And the theories still go on. There was a theory now debunked that blamed the Jesuits for the Titanic. They and J.P. Morgan wanted to set up the Federal Reserve, but three bankers stood in the way, so they arranged to have the Titanic built. the three bankers to be on it, and the ship sunk. And then they started World War I. Also, Freemasons faked the moon landing. The 9/11 attacks were part of a hidden war between Islam and the descendants of the Knights Templar. One theorist, David Icke, surmises that the Illuminati, the Bilderberg Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the United Nations, and, yes, Bob Hope, are all controlled by a larger network called the Babylonian Brotherhood, who are actually blood-drinking humanoid reptiles from another world. Smells like whiskey and LSD to me, but one thing is certain. The Jesuits, back in the day, wanted to bring contemplative mysticism to all people. To rebuild the spiritual life of the church, their exercises became the basis for Jesuit training, and they then gave these exercises to others in what became known as retreats. That's right, the Jesuits invented the retreat. So the next time your company has an off-site meeting, blame St. Ignatius of Loyola, not your HR staff. Or reptoid invaders, as far as that goes. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
Oh, and thanks for thinking too.
Then everybody's in on the conspiracy. The FBI and the CIA and J. Edgar Hoover and oil companies and the Pentagon and the men's room attendant at the White House.
I would leave out the men's room attendant.
Oh,
I'm Chris Morgan, bear ecologist and host of the PBS Nature series, Bears of the Last Frontier. Grizzly bear populations in the lower 48 states teeter on the brink of survival. It's estimated there are only 1,600 grizzlies south of the Canadian border. The long-term persistence of the grizzly depends on having plenty of room to roam. But development is consuming wildlife habitat at a breathtaking rate. The Vital Ground Foundation works on behalf of the threatened grizzly bear by purchasing and protecting habitat. But rather than acquiring vast acreages, they are selective, acquiring smaller parcels that connect forests and parks that are already protected. Their decisions are based on scientific research conducted by ecologists like me. And so far, Vital Ground has helped conserve and restore thousands of acres, which are used by wildlife as feeding grounds and as corridors between protected habitats. For every developed acre, the enduring survival of the great grizzly is threatened. To find out how you can help provide them with the space they need, visit vitalground.org.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show. If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan is a comprehensive public community college serving about 18,000 students each year in Southeast Michigan. HFCC is dedicated to preparing students for the rapidly changing workplace in today's world by offering more than 100 associate degree and university transfer programs. HFCC also specializes in customized workforce development training for business and industry. Since its founding in 1938, HFCC has been the gateway to higher education for thousands of students who seek an affordable, high-quality post-secondary education. To learn more about what HFCC has to offer, please visit us at www.hfcc.edu or you can call the campus office at 1-800-585-HFCC. Your future begins now, and it begins right here at Henry Ford Community College.
Henry Ford Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future?
Hi, this is Stone Perkins from the Five Gear Show on Saturday nights. Is your tunage diet a little short on... Or maybe you're looking for a little. Or maybe you just need some.
Hey, oh, let's go.
Well, I think I have the answer for you. Join me every Saturday night at 8 p.m. for the Five Gear Show. It's a show that features music from the 1960s all the way up to hot and fresh off the meat rack. Punk, blues, indie, ska, garage, rockabilly, psychobilly, but no willy-nilly. Well, maybe a little. A tunage du jour served up every Saturday night at 8 o'clock sharp. The Five Gear Show with me, Stone, right here on WHFR 89.3 FM or WHFR.FM for you webiniters.
you're hearing new music from Charlie Peacock. Each week on Light from the Underground, I spotlight songwriters. I'm your host, Bill Keith, and I enjoy digging through all the new releases we've received to find the best new music for you. Some of the artists you'll hear include lesser-known artists like Flying Colors, The Choir, and The Civil Wars. We'll also mix in classic artists making new and creative music, but it doesn't stop there. You'll also hear new sounds from artists making a go of it right here in Michigan. Check out Light from the Underground on the second and fourth Saturdays at 10 a.m. on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making waves. Mercy, Lord, if you will.
WHFR, Dearborn.
WHFR, the station making waves, proudly presents The Best of Broadway, a program featuring the best of American musical theater. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Joe, your host. We've taken care of your tickets. Now let me escort you through 2 hours of enjoyment of The Best of Broadway.
Welcome once again to The Best of Broadway. I'm Joe, your host, here on the station making waves, WHFR.FM online, 89.3 on your FM dial. And we're coming to you from the beautiful campus of Henry Ford College in the world-class community of Dearborn, Michigan. Well, we've got quite a lot for you today. We've got two plays. The first will be Peter Pan, and then we'll be followed up by Motown the Musical. Now, Peter Pan first opened on Broadway in October 20, 1954. It starred Mary Martin, and